This year marks the 100th anniversary of World War I. France suffered a higher percentage of casualties, over 4% of its total population, than any other country, and the legacy of that bled into the rise of fascism and the outbreak of World War II. In his new book, The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914-1940, cultural historian Frederick Brown explores the events, political and social and religious movements in France that arose after the Dreyfus Affair that led a portion of France's elites to treat the crushing defeat of 1940 as history's judgment on a corrupt and senile society and to embrace Hitler's new order rather than to struggle against it. It's published by Knopf and brings Frederick Brown, who's also the author of For the Soul of France, Culture Wars in the Age of Dreyfus, also biographies of Emile Zola and Gustave Flaubert, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
This is the logical follow-up to For the Soul of France, which dealt with the culture wars connected to the Dreyfus Affair.
That's right.
And you actually devote the first 100 pages to the years before 1914.
Yes, that's right.
Wasn't the Third Republic from 1870 to 1940 troubled throughout its history?
Yes, it was. It was troubled from birth. It was crippled from birth. Because of all the compromises that had to be made to satisfy different factions, and that certainly related to what I'm talking about, what I'm writing about in the book.
How relevant is the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 and Germany's annexation of Alsace-Lorraine?
It's extremely relevant. In fact, people have taken exception with the title. And told me that it really should be 1870 to 1940, because the first part of it really does have to do with the latter part of the 19th century and the origins of so much that troubled France, that vexed France in the 20th century. Yes,
they were humiliated by the Franco-Prussian War, but yes. Why did they move in the direction that they moved? Really also about a split in the intelligentsia,
exactly.
Left and right.
Exactly. Well, take the Dreyfus Affair. The Dreyfus Affair was essentially a civil war, and at stake was the continued existence of the Republic itself. There was enormous hostility to it, and it really expressed itself, manifested itself in anti-Dreyfusism. Dreyfus was a sort of icon. He emblemized the Republic, the obnoxious Republic in the eyes of those who were opposed to it, and it was the attempt was to bring down the Republic on the part of Dreyfusard. The anti-Dreyfusard were really not only anti-Semitic, not only opposed to Dreyfus, not only xenophobic, but opposed to the Republic, to the enemy within. The enemy within was the Republic.
Well, even before Dreyfus, in 1886, Edouard Drumont published a couple of anti-Semitic works, La France Juive and La France Juive Devant, L'Opinion. Were they popular?
They were immensely popular.
Were the people blaming the defeat in the Franco-Prussian War on Jews?
They were blaming it on cosmopolites, and the Jew was the preeminent cosmopolite. That is, he was the spy, and the spy was identified with those Frenchmen who had no roots in France, who had no allegiance to the country, and
do you think that everyone who was anti-Dreyfus really believed that he was guilty? Because the case was quite weak.
Well, you know, Leonard, it has as much to do with proof as a biblical tale. I mean, Dreyfus was never exculpated, even after he was. He became a kind of biblical figure, and a biblical figure can never be Proof is not essential to the condemnation.
And this was all happening at a time when there was incredible anger toward the state, anger that it was even more virulent than we see sometimes today, where people will shoot up a place because they're so angry with government. Robert Bresson likened the France to a syphilitic old whore, stinking of patchouli and yeast infection. That's very clever, but rather ugly at the same time.
Oh, well, I mean, there were no limits. There were no inhibitions at all. I mean, it's amazing to read papers, newspapers of that period and later in the 1930s as well. The anti-Semitism was blatant in the pen of someone like Léon Daudet and Charles Maurras, who figure importantly in the book.
Was it just anti-Semitism? Was it also xenophobia in general?
Well, it was xenophobia in general, yes. Of course, the Jews were often linked with the Germans. Rothschild, for example, was never just a Jew. He was a German-Jewish banker. The Jew also, of course, embodied capitalism, and cosmopolitan capital, not international capital. Capital had no allegiance to France. I mean, it's important that Drummond, whom you mentioned a while ago, was actually not only virulently anti-Semitic, he was virulently populist and anti-capitalist.
To better understand the political environment of the period, you focus on the works of three writers and public intellectuals of the day, Maurice Barrès, Charles Maurras, and also Pierre Dreux La Rochelle. In general terms, what insights do these writers give us into this moment in French history?
Well, I see them as a sort of continuum. I mean, I see them as generations influencing one another. Dreux La Rochelle is the youngest of them, and like others, other young writers of that generation, intellectual generation, it was actually quite deeply impressed by, influenced by Barrès. Barrès is one of those figures who's been almost completely eclipsed today. The only book of his read sometimes in university is a book called The Deracinated, The Uprooted. Had enormous influence, he did, on our generation. And then Maurras was more or less a contemporary and a royalist, but a friend of Barrès. Dreux La Rochelle followed. He came later, and I find him a particularly interesting figure.
Because his politics changes. He also writes one of the masterpieces of French literature, Le Feu Follet.
Yes, that's true. But he also, he illustrates so much of what was going on, this flocking of the intelligentsia to extremes. When I call in the title Unreason, what I mean by that is the extreme left and the extreme right, fascism and communism. And he, at times, sort of wavered between the two. What shall I choose? What identity, what political identity shall I assume, this or that? And that's one of the things that made him so interesting to me.
My guest is Frederick Brown, who is the author of several award-winning books, including For the Soul of France, Flaubert, also he wrote a book on Zola, and now The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914 to 1940. It is published by Knopf. Interestingly, Maurice Barrès contended that he wasn't anti-Jewish, just that his politics were anti-Semitic.
Well, yes.
Does that make him an opportunist, or is it just a subtle difference that I'm not picking up on?
Well, it certainly makes him an ideologue. He subscribed to all the myths surrounding the Jew. In private life, he may very well have had Jewish friends. Actually, I'm not aware of who they may have been, but that it may be possible. However, you know, they're always good Jews.
Some of his best friends.
It was his best friends may have been Jews. The ideology was certainly anti-Semitic. And that's what counted.
Barras actually got into politics. He started the Patriot League. There were a number of different groups like that.
Yes.
Did they vary in their virulence?
Yes, they certainly did. The League of which he was president was not as virulent as others. There was a League that they had similar names. It's easy to confuse them. The League de la Patrie Française was far more virulent. And Action Française, the royalist Catholic newspaper, had a sort of paramilitary wing called the Camelot du Roi, hawkers of the king, and they were hooligans essentially. They did a lot, at least a lot of they were responsible for a lot of hooliganism.
Action Française had a newspaper.
That's right, the same name.
And Morin was involved with that, but he also wrote editorials for La Cocarde. What does La Cocarde mean?
La Cocarde.
Yeah.
La Cocarde is the. Well, you've got me. What is La Cocarde? I think it's a. It's certainly an emblem. Whether a hat or a flag. I can't. I'm slightly embarrassed by this.
Well, there's that famous French hat.
It's a hat. It must be that.
Well, he would attack France as the Jew state, the Masonic state, the immigrant state.
Yes.
The Masons also came under attack.
Yes, the Masons were also their bête noire.
Were these kinds of writings having an impact on the general public? Or is this just a debate within the intelligentsia?
Well, the Action Française, the influence of Action Française was rather extensive. When you consider that, for example, the newspaper was widely subscribed to by Catholic parishes throughout France. It said that in every presbytery in France you were going to find a copy of the Action Française. I mean, there was a moment later, for complicated reasons, in the 1920s when Action Française or Maurras was excommunicated by the Pope. But by and large...
For what reason? For his anti-Semitism?
Well, No. The Catholic Church is not going to do that.
They would have had to excommunicate a lot of people.
They would have had to excommunicate a lot of their own. But it was because... several, enlightened archbishops in France declared that he was merely using Catholicism to propagate the cause of royalism, but he was not a believer.
Well, the right fought for the canonization of Joan of Arc.
That's right,
and that was kind of a litmus test of sorts.
Yes, it was. It was. But that was earlier. This was before the excommunication. No, that's an important chapter, I think, in the book, because
why Joan of Arc? I mean, obviously she is a hero
because
nationalists, but she's more complicated. She's not a symbol of right-wing thinking.
Well, she became a symbol of right-wing thinking. I mean, she could be whatever you made of her. She was clay, and she was fashioned into statues throughout Paris. And one of them being a statue went up in 1874, which became a pilgrimage site for extreme right wingers, and still is
at the Place de Pyramide.
Place de Pyramide.
Marine Le Pen is organizing processionals to it.
That's right, exactly.
For the same reason?
Well, these people their ideologies have changed to some extent. Marine Le Pen is much more interested in African immigrants than in Jews, but the xenophobia is there. And at bottom, probably, one would have to say anti-republicanism.
Your title is The Embrace of Unreason. And in art, unreason was at the core of Dadaism.
That's right.
And surrealism,
That's
which
right.
grew out of it. But
right.
Those artists were all on the left.
Yeah, they were all on the left. But I think I had unreason was a word I chose because it seemed to me the only one I could find, at any rate, that embraced a phenomena on the right and the left, which had in common, at bottom, profound anti-intellectualism. Barrès, all the people we've spoken of, dismissed or expressed hostility toward the values of the French Enlightenment. And in art, in surrealism, let's say, we have what? We have a group of writers who are pledging themselves to the unconscious from which they propose to take dictation in their creative lives. And I, just to continue along that line for a minute, my thought throughout was that all of these people, throughout this period of war and social mobility and industrialization, are seeking something inalienable, an inalienable identity. Some found it in fascism, others in communism. The surrealists who courted the Communist Party in the unconscious. That is where they felt their something. They had a core which transcended daily life.
It's been suggested that this is also the time of the three great Andres: André Breton, who was the leader of the Surrealists, but also André Malraux and André Gide.
Yes,
and they are not irrationalists.
No, they're not. Well,
Gide was much loved during this time. So there had to be another strain that was going through French intellectual
life. Yes. Well, Malraux, one of them was the fashion of the intellectual fashion of communism. How many intellectuals felt that their bona fides had to do with their association with the Communist Party? Gide is a complicated man. He, in the 1930s, I guess, earlier, he went to the Congo and wrote a book called Voyage to the Congo, and that had a great influence on him. I think from that point on, he began to move toward a political position.
My crack staff has come up with the meaning of La Cocarde. It's La Cocarde tricolore, the circle badge of the red, white, and blue rings that represent the French Republic created during the French Revolution, the circular insignia with a blue dot in the middle.
Fantastic.
My guest is Frederick Brown. His latest book, The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914-1940, published by Knopp. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Frederick Brown. His latest book, The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914-1940, published by Knopp. What was the significance of the Stavisky affair on French society in 1934?
Well, Stavisky was a con artist. He had a Ponzi scheme of enormous proportions. It was comparable to... What's his name?
Bernard Madoff.
It was comparable to Bernard Madoff. But it also had more political implications because a lot of the people who were complicit in the Ponzi scheme were congressmen or deputies, as they were called, who were on the take. He provided money since a number of the system was different. His Ponzi scheme required, in a number of cases, authorization, government authorization for issues. And that's one of the reasons he was able to acquire authorization. It really resulted in an enormous financial collapse.
Since Stavisky was a Jewish immigrant.
He was a Jewish immigrant, yes.
Really galvanized the right?
Yes, it certainly did.
One of the people you focus on, you mentioned him earlier, was Pierre La Rochelle. He was anti-Hitler in the early 30s. What happened?
Well, one of the things that the answers immediately occurs to me is his visit to Nuremberg in 1936, the Nuremberg Festival, and everything that surrounds festivals in France, the effect it had on people, including de La Rochelle. He came away absolutely ecstatic at the spectacle of an entire, what it seemed to him, an entire nation participating in an ecstatic ritual. This, it seemed to him, is the answer to, or the cure for, French decadence. This is how a state should look and behave.
So he went from left to right?
He went from, definitely went from left to right, yes.
And he was already an established novelist. I mentioned his famous novel, The Feu Follet, The
Yes,
Fire Within,
that's right.
Which was made into a brilliant film a few years back.
That's right.
But something similar happened with Louis Ferdinand Céline, considered by many to be one of the world, the, at least France's greatest 20th century novelists. His first two novels, the ones that made him famous, led people to believe that he would be very opposed to the kinds of things that the fascists stood for, anti-Semitism, anti-Masons. And yet when he started writing pro-Nazi screeds, I seem to remember André Gide said he thought they were the most brilliant satires against the craziness of Nazism until it became apparent that he was being sincere.
That's right. Well, it's true that Céline is barely mentioned in this book, but then there are other significant figures who aren't. Yeah, I mean, there was quite a lot of that. The Action Française, I referred to a little while ago, they were in their xenophobia embraced Germany. They were definitely, anti-German. And in fact, in the 1920s, Maurras was one of those who in the 1930s, I should say, recognized the military threat of Hitler's military threat before the left did, and wanted urged rearmament. But as the decade proceeded, and Vichy came to pass. Vichy was, in Maurras's eyes, a redemptive government.
Well, I would have thought that people whose nationalist feelings began with the defeat in the Franco-Prussian War would have been opposed to Germany all along, simply because there's this historical precedent.
Well, I think that that's to underestimate.
And then the Napoleonic Wars would have been an even earlier precedent.
Yes. Well, what can one say? What I would say is that one mustn't underestimate the French hatred for the French. the French sort of self-hatred. The civil war of the Dreyfus affair is really brings that to the fore. And I think there were numbers of French intellectuals in the 1930s who were welcoming the possibility of an invasion by Hitler, because France needed a Hitler. One of those people
needed
comes
a cleansing.
They needed cleansing. Yes, they needed this lame, decadent republic to be swept away, along with all of those values associated with individualism. I mean, that's an important word in my book.
How did the anti-Dreyfusards react when it became apparent that Dreyfus hadn't been a spy and he was exonerated?
Nothing was apparent. I mean, they were absolutely dedicated to this.
Even after he was released?
Oh, absolutely. The Dreyfus affair continued. It never ended for them. It continued into the into the 30s, 40s. And I'm sure even today you'll find people who believe devoutly in Dreyfus's guilt. As I said, he was Judas. Judas can never be. There are no proof. There's nothing probative in connection with the biblical tale.
So many contradictions in this story, because Léon Blum becomes the first socialist premier of France. He's also the first Jewish premier of France, although
yes.
When He assumed office, I gather. A member of parliament said something like, his name was Xavier Vallat, said, "Your assumption of power, Mr. Prime Minister, is unquestionably an historic event. For the first time, this old Gallo-Roman land will be governed by a Jew. I say what I think and bear the disagreeable burden of saying aloud what others only think, which is that this peasant nation would be better served by someone whose origins, however modest, reach into the entrails of our soil than by a subtle Talmudist."
Yes, very well said. Yes, he... Well, you know, this was the Depression. France was suffering. Unemployment was enormous. The strikes all over the place, and it led to a coalition of leftist parties. For the first time, the Communist Party was prepared to associate itself with the Socialist Party, from which it had split.
So we have the Popular Front.
A Popular Front. And the most important of these parties on the right was the Socialist Party, of which Blum was the chair, and he thus became the prime minister.
And also was beaten at one point by Action Française.
Yes. This
followers.
Was only a few months before he assumed power as prime minister. He was caught in a traffic jam because there was an Action Française funeral procession. One of their pillars had died, and they were having procession down the Rue Saint-Germain, the Avenue Saint-Germain. He was spied by members of Action Française and beaten very, very badly.
Do you see any parallels between some of the sentiments of this time and what we're seeing today in many parts of Europe, where there's a resurgent right and very strong anti-immigrant feelings? And in some countries like Hungary and people, at least the Russians are claiming, Ukraine, anti-Semitism?
Yes, depressing. But people don't seem to change very much. Given the appropriate circumstances, I think the same phenomena seem to arise. Xenophobia and a scapegoat.
In this country, we have people denying that the reason they are so angry with Washington is that the president is an African-American.
And denying it, you
say? I'm thinking of Leon Blum in the same way that I'm thinking of Barack Obama. I'm sure there are many things that aren't parallel.
Yes. Well, yes, there is a parallel. There's certainly a parallel. It's just that it was so much more blatant. In France, one of the things for which, in a way, as an author, I'm thankful, is the utter transparency with which people express themselves. The bigotry with regard to Obama, I think, is much more veiled, or tends to be more veiled. But I think that there's certainly a parallel. Yes.
What happened in the following story? I'm assuming that since you've already written about the Dreyfus years and now 1914 to 1940, your next book will be about Vichy?
Well, you know, I may have retired from French politics, from French cultural history, but that would, of course, be the logical. But I must say, the Vichy regime has been so well written about. And so it's a field that's been so well plowed that I'm reluctant to enter it.
On the other hand, it's a time of great myth. Marcel Ophuls made a film in which he looked at all of the French myths about resistance to the Nazis, and then talked to people and found that most people pretty much went along with the government.
Yes, I'm afraid that's I mean, you know, there's a, what was it, a sort of a, well, it's a sort of running joke after the war. The numbers of people who, as it turns out, were members of the resistance. Everybody claimed to be a member of the resistance. So,
well, what about the people who you've written about who were played major roles in leading to the attitudes that underlie Vichy? I know Céline was tried in absentia, and found guilty, although later pardoned, because it was also recognized he's a great writer. What happened to some of these other people?
Well, Leonard, an awful lot of them, and it's a sobering realization, a number of them fled. Well, some were tried, but there weren't many executions after the war. There were several collaborators who were executed, but
there were more women who had their heads shaved.
Had their heads shaved and paraded in public. But numbers fled, and were an amnesty was declared. They were able to come back. De Gaulle wanted, really, as much to the extent possible, to sweep things under the table, because he felt that France had to transcend the enmities of the past and recover from the war and the occupation.
Now, in the in light of the blaming of Stavisky, rightly so, wasn't there a man named Louis Daquet who was also an embezzler, and he wound up becoming a leader of extreme right-wing groups?
Well, yes, he was Daquet de Pellepoix. That's right. I mention him only one of the reviews of the book. He's mentioned more prominently, but he's a lamentable figure who had failed in everything he attempted. He came from a rather an enlightened family. His brother worked for a Jewish firm, a grain import export firm. He failed at that. He failed at other things, and he came into his own as a vehement anti-Semite. He in the late 1930s, and so much so, so successful at that was he, that the Vichy regime made him the commissioner or commissar of Jewish affairs.
He had,
as a result of which, he was responsible for deporting a lot of Jews to Auschwitz.
And was he punished?
Daquet de Pellepoix was one of those people who fled. And he fled to Spain, and there he remained.
Under the protection of Franco.
Yes, and did, I think, rather well.
Well, the name of his journal that he edited is kind of shocking in its own right, Le Anti-Juif.
Yes, L'Anti-Juif. Yes, that's what I mean by the blatancy.
Frederick Brown's book, The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914-1940, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much for having me, Leonard. Thank you very much.